My name is Jan Boosten. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the CCW program on the project Architect of Peace on the Colombian Peace Process. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Neil Ferguson, Professor of Political Psychology at the Liverpool Hope University, and to the Tuesday seminars lunchtime series. And as a researching fellow, as a visiting researcher fellow, he's not a stranger to CCW. And just to quickly, go through the usual, Professor Ferguson has published quite widely in both psychology and political journals, and amongst others, published in the Journal of Journalism and Mass Communication Equality, Democracy and Security, Political Psychology, International Journal of Conflict and Violence, Peace and Conflict, Journal of Peace Psychology, Peace Research, International Journal of Behavioral Development, and Political Psychology, to just name a few. And in addition, of course, his work has appeared in numerous edited volumes, and he himself has edited quite a few volumes on the psychology of becoming a combatant and the processes after violence has ceased. And today's presentation falls into the second category and explores the processes involved in leaving social movements or disengaging from terrorist activities towards engaging in non-military civil society. Certainly the most interesting approach of his research is that it combines macro processes taking place at the institutional level with micro processes taking place at the group or individual level. And it's therefore not surprising that he not only made scholarly contribution, but has advised various governments, NGOs, think tanks, and so forth on issues around radicalization, terrorism, and counterterrorism. I have, of course, a very selfish interest in the issue, studying Colombia, because Colombia is facing, of course, the Herculean task of transforming a guerrilla force into that is an experience of six decades of jungle warfare into a legal political force. But whatever your regional interest may be, Professor Ferguson's own work has made it readily apparent that his findings are applicable to other contexts other than Northern Ireland. So I'm sure we will learn a lot from today's presentation and will have an equally vibrant discussion. And let's welcome Professor Ferguson to Oxford University.
Thanks so much, Jan, and thanks very much for giving me time to come along to the talk. As Jan was saying, we're going to have a look at sort of the end cycle, I guess, people leaving violence behind. So I'm going to deal, I guess, trying to look at the sort of issues around de-radicalization, disengagement from violence, thinking about, I guess, coming from a terrorism studies perspective, with psychologists at heart. So it's hardly surprised anybody that since 9/11 there's been a huge growth in interest in issues around terrorism, radicalization, de-radicalization. To the extent that you can't read everything that's published anymore, there's just so much material getting published, particularly around issues around radicalization. It's also very true that this work is generally very, very poor. Lots of reliance on secondary data sets, no one really engaged in work in the field, people interloping, coming in, writing attacks, getting off again, going back to whatever it is they do for their day job. So the work hasn't really grown in significance in that time particularly well. At the same time, there is kind of a growing awareness of the complexity of the problem. Okay, so the research has become more complex, more nuanced. The range of factors that are being considered is more widespread. And particularly on the radicalization side, so how do people get involved with armed groups? How do people engage in the violence? The factors that lead into that has got a lot more consideration. And the models that are being developed that are getting a little bit more sophisticated. In terms of how people leave violence behind, de-radicalize or disengage from the violence, it's much more limited, but again, it's beginning to grow, the body of work as well, but not as sophisticated in terms of the radicalization literature. So one of the issues in this area is this big debate about whether we need something called de-radicalization, or what is it, or can we have disengagement? It's this idea that if you want people to leave violence behind, do we have to de-radicalize them? Okay, so things to think about. So we think of disengagement as what I'm mainly talking about today, is the people who have a behavioural change, i.e. they don't kill people anymore. Okay, so they've stopped the violence, they're not robbing people, they're not involved in the criminality, they're moving away from that. So it's behavioral change. As you'll see as you go through, I'm not arguing these people are de-radicalized. If anything, the process of their engagement in violence has radicalized them more, and they're more radical at the end than they were at the beginning. Whereas we have de-radicalization, which is this, I guess, at its basic, is this idea that we have both this cognitive change and a behavioral change. So people change the reasons for doing it. There's a change in why they're doing it, ideological shift. And what I'm really going to look at is this idea that, personally, as we'll see, I don't really think that de-radicalization is a necessary in this route towards ending violent extremism. Okay, we could do it with a disengagement. But again, this is a very simple look at that. All these topics are much more nuanced, much more complicated than I give them time for now. Okay, so look at the overview. How does disengagement work? Basically, there's lots of different factors. You have your societal level factors, you have community level factors, you've got the personnel of the individual, intra-individual, intergroup. All these kind of processes are involved in it. But you can break it down into sort of little steps. Either the individual combatant decides he or she has had enough and is going to stop killing people, is going to stop getting engaged in this terrorist activity or paramilitary activity. Or, as we've probably seen more so in Northern Ireland, we have a group level disengagement. The group itself, for a variety of different reasons, have decided that the militarism is not the way forward. We need to go into community work, we need to go into politics, we need to go into other fields and leave the violence behind. And again, people do this for a variety of reasons. One, you can voluntarily do that. So your group itself could decide, well, we're not going to achieve our political goals by using violence. We need to find a new way of moving forward. Or it's forced. So basically, there's decapitation of your organization, leadership's killed off, the organization fractures and breaks down and has been forced into disengagement. And again, these processes, as we'll see, can be temporary. So people will come in, leave the organization, maybe go to prison, after their imprisonment, leave the organization, get themselves a nice job as a shopkeeper, for example, then after a while, come back into the organization, get involved in the political side or welfare or back into the military side and things like that. Or they could be permanent. I mean, the easiest way to bring about permanent disengagement is obviously to kill the person. So once they're killed, they're permanently disengaged, they're not going to do it again, okay? But for most people, it's a very nebulous activity. People drift in, drift out over time. So if we break down the processes, we can look at it a bit like that. So if you look across the literature in this area, there's a number of sort of common factors that people cite when we're trying to understand why people leave these armed groups or why these armed groups might fold. One of the arguments really is that basically the organisations will collapse and people will all leave. So, you know, if you get involved, most people who get involved in these armed groups are young men, okay, not being sexist, but they're young men. They get involved in their teenage years, their early 20s, and basically through their life their priorities will change and eventually off their own they'll stop doing it. Okay, and a lot of factors play into that, things like physical, psychological and socioeconomic stress, and we'll talk a bit about that as we go through the talk, because these are key factors for the people who were involved in research that I'm going to talk about. It's hard work. You know, if you're on the run from the security agency, the security services, the police agencies are disrupting you and harassing you. Perhaps there's threats to your life from people within your own organization, people from oppositional organizations. You're in hides, you're not seeing your family, you can't get a job, you can't hold down a job. There's all these sort of problems, a lot of psychological, physical pressure and socioeconomic pressure. A factor we'll say that's important is aging. You know, you grow up, you have kids, your life kind of changes. So these changing life priorities, the things that were important to you when you're 15, 16, not so important to you in 34, 45, or whatever it happens to be. One of the common side factors is this idea that you lose faith in the group ideology. You realize when you get onto the battlefield or join the group that they're not really stand up for the things that you thought they were going to stand up. Maybe they're more interested in money or dealing drugs or whatever it happens to be. You know, perhaps if you go off to, you mentioned Afghanistan, so you get yourself into Afghanistan, you're back in a little truck and a missile hits you, you think maybe not the best thing to do, you know, to get involved in these groups. Like any sort of job, disillusionment of the group dynamics, the people you work with, you don't get on with, these sort of issues, very personal issues. Issues around, one of the common ideas is this idea that the violence itself, after a while, you get sort of sickened by the violence, so you realise that the violence is counterproductive to achieving the group goals, your political goals and things like that. So these are kind of common factors that people see within lots of different groups who are engaged in politically motivated violence. And we'll see some of them as we go through today. So the groups I'm particularly going to talk about today are the UVF and the RHC. So basically, this is the Ulster Volunteer Force and the Red Hand Commando. So again, these are groups from Northern Ireland that we're going to look at. These groups, unlike the IRA, were pro-British. Okay, so they're basically trying to maintain, using violence to maintain the status quo in Northern Ireland, to keep Northern Ireland part of the United Kingdom. So some people would have seen them as conservative or preservational terrorists, if you would, a label. If you look at what they did during the conflict, over the duration of the Troubles, about 1,700 people were killed, depending on how you count it and who you include. But you can say the Loyalist paramilitaries killed almost 30% of those victims. Most of those victims that they killed as well are civilians, so not necessarily members of the IRA or Republicans, but general civilians. The groups themselves went on ceasefire in 1994. The leadership of the groups were always very pro-agreement, so during the peace negotiations in the mid to late 1990s, were very pro-agreement, looking to move forward, moving to peace processes. 10 years ago, the joint leadership of the UVF and the Red Hand Commando said that they're going to assume a non-militarized civilian role. Okay, so they're going to stop being engaged in military activity. They're going to become involved in more like community activism, community work, local politics, things like that. Then 2 years later, they commissioned all their weapons, or apparently commissioned all their weapons. This was verified that they'd done so. But just a year later, they murdered, there was a sanctioned murder of Bobby Moffat, who was a and also had been a UVF member and had riled up some other members of the leadership. So clearly they hadn't decommissioned all of their weaponry. Since then, they've been involved in paramilitary style attacks, you know, this is the sort of punishment beatings and things like that. Involved in coordinating sectarian riots, particularly around the flag protests that we had in Belfast. Involved in political protests, but also involved in bringing about solutions to some of the political protests. If you think of the Trudell Avenue protests and things like that, they were very instrumental in bringing those to an end. As well as that, they have been targeting distant Republicans. So although on paper they're supposed to have given up this militarism, there has been a big debate within the organisation about what the response would be to Irish dissidents and distant Irish Republicans if they committed, for example, if they killed other loyalists or killed Protestants and things like that. So they've been involved in kind of targeting, intelligence gathering and things like that on potential targets in that community. And quite recently, then the Red Hand Command have actually applied to the Secretary of State to have the prescribed status removed. So the idea they won't become a legal organisation, able to operate under the label of Red Hand Commando and do their community work and conflict transformation work under this label. Okay, so that's currently where we are. And if you want to, I've talked to some Red Hand Commando members recently, so if you want to talk about that later, I'm happy to talk about why they're doing this at a later date. So what are the factors that really push people to kind of begin to move away? As I said already, it's hard work. So aging is an important process in two ways. One, you get older, okay? So you kind of mellow down. As your guy says there, you know, you mellow out, you become a bit wiser, you think things through a little bit better, you're not as hot-headed as you might have been in your youth. But it also has an impact in terms of your ability to operate in the field. Okay, so if you've gone to prison, you're known to the security services, you're known to the police, you know, you're going to get caught. You're no good doing that kind of work anymore. People know who you are, so you're not as effective in your field craft as you could have been. You know, people would joke and say things like, well, you know, at my age, you're not going to make the getaway car anymore. You know, you're not going to do that run, you know. So there's those kind of physical changes, psychological changes, changes in where you are in your life. Interesting as well, I mean, if you look at a lot of research about how people get engaged with these groups, family, friendship groups, these kind of things are very important in people's roots in Durham groups. If you look at people, for example, who traveled to Syria to join ISIS, most people did that in little cliques of people, individual friendship groups and things like that. Same in Northern Ireland, family and friendship is very important. But interestingly as well, when people look at how they've come out of the organisation, those relationships again are quite central in supporting that activity. So I was quite surprised when I was doing this research how many of these former loyalist combatants, former ex-prisoners. So these are people who have been served long sentences for sectarian related crimes, are now in romantic relationships with Catholic women. Okay, so this kind of change, but also you can see there this guy's talking about, you know, sometimes it took violence to push it along that way, but everything I've done, you know, I've justified that. My end goal is not being anything other than to have peace and have a good society for all of Northern Ireland. It's kind of counterintuitive idea that the violence in some way is there to bring about peace. But very, I'll probably talk about this again, this idea about this sort of idea of not wanting the next generation to have to perpetrate that violence, okay? That you've had to witness the brutality of the violence, you've seen friends killed, you've done killing, you're psychologically harmed. I mean, I think about 40% of the population have GHQ scores that indicate they've got mental health issues. PTSD, probably about 50% shows symptomology of PTSD. So these are very harmed population. So they don't want other people to have to live through that. So it's a kind of an issue about not wanting the conflict to go on again for the fictive children of Northern Ireland, so for children more generally, but also for the children they've had as they've grown up, their own children, grandchildren, things like that. One of the key issues for my population was prison, in terms of how they got to moving from a militaristic point of view to trying to solve the conflict through violence, to trying to solve the conflict through negotiation and peace, was really going to prison. Okay, so, and some of the other research that I've looked at are how people got involved. When they get involved in the violence, they're politically naive. They don't have a notion. They're not educated. Some of them are very, very, very poorly educated. No historical knowledge about Northern Ireland. They're really getting involved in violence at a very local level. They're running with gangs. There's things happening in the streets. There's things happening in the area. And they get brought into the violence like that. It's not really thought out political violence as such. Okay, but when they go to prison, there's a kind of a space to think. And also, some of the ceasefires do the same thing. They provide the groups, the combatant groups, with the space to come together, reformulate your ideas, and think of a longer-term strategy. Okay, so when you're in the hot conflict, all you're thinking about is, how do I kill X? How do I stop X from killing me? So it's a very, 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 very short-termism in terms of your strategic outlook. So a prison gives people to sit back, reflect, think of the bigger picture, do some education, think about widely. Okay, so as this member said, you know, some people say the likes of the maze and places like that were universities of terrorism. That's a common phrase people use about the maze. There were terrorist training camps, but I actually believe they were universities of peace in terms of how we discussed in there, how we decided, how we came about in our discussions, how we're going to get out of this. Okay, so they give people the space and the resources to think about this. Okay, so people, in a way, got radicalized in prison, politically radicalized, ideologically radicalized, but it helped them move towards peace, not away from peace. So again, there's another example of that, how these processes work. We have this kind of growing political radicalization. People are looking towards, I mean, if you're Republican prisoners, you're looking at Che Guevara, and you're looking at socialism, you're looking at all these different ideas, political ideas, and you're looking at different education. You're reading different policy documents, you're analysing policy documents, doing critical evaluation, you're coming together in discussion groups, what's going on, how do we move forward, how do we change. You're reflecting on why you got there, why did you do that attack, why were you involved in that violence, what were your motivations, what were you trying to achieve. And also within the prison, you're also negotiating with the prison authorities, you're learning these skills, negotiation skills. You're also negotiating with other armed groups that are in different wings. So you're understanding the world from their perspective as well. You're beginning to sort of develop your skills, your negotiation skills, your educational skills, your historical knowledge, your political acumen. So it really helps people move forward. And again, this quote to sort of illustrate that, you know, I went to prison in 1980, and if you have any sort of grey matter in your head at all, you have to start and analyse where you finished up in prison. And just my thing was just reinforced by the fact that everything wasn't as black and white as I'd seen it. Prison just gives you an opportunity to be detached from it. It's a dubious way to be attached, but you're detached from it and it gives you time to think. Okay, so the idea, you know, once you go in, you get that space, you can bring people together, get a critical mass of people to discuss ideas. And as he said, you know, whenever you go outside, people don't understand that because they're still involved in this short-term, tit-for-tat, violent cycle. So they can't develop their political ideas. They're on the run, they're hiding from the police and the security agencies, they're planning operations, they're not really thinking in a bigger... and have a bigger viewpoint, whereas prison gives these people the time to do that. so in a way, what I'm saying is, well, this radicalization that people have, this political radicalization, ideological awakening that comes within prison, when you see them outside of prison, that also then begins to, that's the thing that's fueling their activity, the conflict transformation activity. So why are they doing community work? Why are they running football clubs at 12 o'clock at night on a Friday to take youth off the street? Why are they doing these educational projects? Why are they doing welfare with prisoners? Why are they working with bands to try to get bands to understand legislation? Why are they doing all this work? And a lot of it's got to do with this kind of skills that were developed within their time in prison and that sort of political ideology. So in a way here, you can see this is a former prisoner. He's talking about working with a group of young adolescents, and he's trying to get them to understand that the conflict wasn't glorious. You know, so you've got the murals on the wall showing you the people with balaclavas and the rifles and glorifying the past. Conversations with their parents when we talked about the good old days when the conflict is on and what happened and how people could leave their doors open and all these kind of things. And just kind of challenge these ideas about how conflict isn't glorious and how the conflict actually can be very, very destructive. And again, this comes to this sort of process of imprisonment and trying to reimagine a new future for people's, their families and their kin as well. So what I'm saying is, you know, what is this process? In some respects, if you look at de-radicalization, you could argue that there's an element of de-radicalization there in that, you know, they're not killing people anymore, their ideas have changed. But it's certainly a kind of a more liberalization of people's attitudes have changed. I mean, as I was saying to Jan on the way up today, you know, a lot of this, people in a way go to prison with very dehumanized ideas about the opponent. Okay, so, you know, all Catholics are targets. You know, if you can't kill that IRA man, kill that IRA man, they're all the same. Okay, people are very dehumanized, de-individualized. But when they go to prison, begin negotiations and talk to people, it helps them re-individualize the opponent. They begin to understand them better, they study them, they see them differently, and their attitudes change as well towards the opponent groups. So, as he said, you can see that change within this person. He's talking about, you know, obviously being a soldier. So this is someone who's now a loyalist paramilitary, but has been a former British Army soldier. So obviously being a soldier and having a lot of hurt come from soldiers and family getting killed by the IRA, I couldn't stand the sight of the other community. I didn't know them. I didn't particularly want to know them. All I'd seen was the hurt that they caused our community. From that now, it's the total opposite. I believe I'm more sort of liberal. I listen to people's belief. Even if I don't agree with them, I accept them. Whereas where I would have thought before the violence would have saw things, now I think the complete opposite. It has to be done in a more democratic way. There has to be a system, etc., etc. Okay, so that's sort of change where people have become rehumanized as well through this process. Key to, I guess, a lot of the change within these armed groups was the leadership. The fact that a lot of people at the top were very peace process, certainly not all the rank and file were peace process supporters. A lot of people would have been very against it. But the leadership was there trying to keep the organisations coherent and trying to get them to transform away from violence, move away from militarism and criminality, and try to move into this more civilianised kind of role. So that's just someone trying to explain that. How do we try to get back to normality? How do you get away from these sort of trappings of paramilitarism and try to bring the organisation forward into a sort of more peaceful, non-conflict role. Okay. One of the key aspects of this whole process is a sense of identity. Okay, so within Northern Ireland, there's a very entrenched sense of an identity within the population. So if you, particularly back during the conflict, if you said to Protestant or Catholic, are you Protestant or Catholic, 70 or 80% of people will have no problem with saying that they're Protestant or Catholic. Okay. Once you get involved with these armed groups, that becomes heightened. So you have all these sort of in-group, small group pressures that push on you to sort of heighten your identity, your sense of self, your sense of belonging to those communities. You become insulated. You're only working within the discourses and the narratives of those organizations. So your worldview narrows. Okay, so you become very, very identified with your group. Identity is very key, very committed. So committed initially to the militaristic activity involved in violence. And then later, that commitment travels through with that radicalized identity in terms of your more positive community kind of work. And this guy's trying to explain that in a way. So, you know, me personally, it seems to be that what I was doing then and what I continue to do, so somebody formerly being involved in the military side of things and now being involved in politics and, I guess, strategic thinking, is to stand up for the loyalist people. What we perceive to be our right not to be downtrodden by republics, by anybody, you know. Nothing has changed with me. I don't see that. It's the same things that are there. So it's the same motivators as driving them. So the motivators that drove a lot of the violence are the same motivators driving the more peace work. And again, this is the counterintuitive thing that most people talk about, well, why they were doing this activity and why they moved away from violence, was this idea of a kind of a belief in the shared future. This idea that in Northern Ireland, you know, it's a no-win situation in terms of conflict. The populations are too evenly matched. No one's ever going to win that war. You know, you've got, what, 55% Protestant, 45% Catholic. It's too even. You know, if they'd been 10% Catholic or 10% Protestant, they could have been wiped out. But it didn't happen like that. So the conflict can't militarize, you can't win it in a military sense. So we have to look forward, look for something else. So we went back to, as they're saying, so a lot of people reflected back on against Ulster Scots and Irish unionism and politics and tradition, and, you know, looked at the Irish, United Irishmen and all these different things. So as he says, so we went back to the Covenant, looked at some of the issues that were in the Ulster Covenant, like civil and religious freedom. And if we really believed, if unionists really believe in civil and religious liberty, then it must be for all of us, for Protestants, for Catholics, for nationalists as well as unionists, and today for the ethnic minorities as well as Indigenous people. So this idea that, you know, we have to move towards this democratic, shared future to get the best solution for all of Ireland rather than any particular ethnic group. And as I said, this is one of the big push for people is this future generations, the idea of not having to have their children or grandchildren do the same things that they did in the conflict. You know, as he said, I don't want any more conflict. All our people that are lining up the jail, that are lying 6 foot under, I don't want another young boy from this estate because some middle-class politician who stirs up the shit and shooting some other young person because they're a different religion. Spending the best years of his life in jail or getting shot dead himself. I don't want that for any of the kids in this estate. I want jobs, I want nice housing, I want a good environment. That's all we want. It's not too much to ask. That's your one life. So this idea, getting to this normal, getting back to normal life, trying to find a better future for everybody. So these are the kind of things that drove people. We're also gonna quickly just look at a couple of barriers that held people back or held this process, as I said. You're looking at the process that's been going on for a long time, okay? So if you think the group was going to stand down in 2007, still there today, 2017. So these processes take a long time. Some of the reasons for that is as the population feel stigmatized. As I said, there's a lot of issues within the population around things like mental health, problems with economic, you know, trying to get a job, I think, what's it? Something like 78-80% of the ex-prisoner population decide to have a financial problems. 50-60% of them have problems getting a job. They feel like second-class citizens within the communities because they can't access the same rights as the individuals because of the criminal record and all this kind of stuff. So particularly within the loyalist community, because people in the loyalist community had a choice. You know, you could join the police, you could join the UDR, you could do something legal to try to combat republicanism if that's what you wanted to do, or you could do the illegal activity and join the paramilitary. So within unionism, there's a big stigma about the fact that these people are bad. These people took an illegal route to try to do that activity, or they could have taken a legal route to do that activity. Okay, so there's that kind of stigma within the unionist community. And then there's a wider stigma, particularly you see within the media, that even when these people do something positive, there's always the idea that they're bad, okay? Because in the past they've done this, in the past they killed someone, in the past they, you know, they bombed somebody, in the past they did this, and they can't move forward from that, and that holds them back. Particularly when they're in competition in the modern world, trying to get funding for projects and move forward with conflict transformation activity, they're competing against, I guess, people who are more professional, you know, civil society organisations that are more respectable and more likely to get money and things like that. So they're kind of held back in that way. And again, as the last person's talking about there, every application form says, have you ever been convicted of a criminal offence? I write no on that for obvious reasons. If I told the truth, rash behaviour, possession of a bomb with intent to endanger life, instructing others in use of firearms and bombs, I mean, what does that say? So again, what tends to happen is they get a job because they lie on the application form. But Northern Ireland's a very small place, so someone knows who you are. They tell the employer, and then you get the sack. Okay, so you can't hold down the job. Still working for in the grey economy, cash in hand kind of work, low pay, labour, you know, this kind of thing. Difficult to kind of sustain a family and livelihood, which makes things difficult. Why does it take so long? It's a difficult process for the organisations to move through. They're trying to keep organisations kind of cohesive. You know, so if you think of the skill set that a lot of these paramilitaries have, perfect jobs in organised crime or criminality or other activity, set up a splinter group, another armed group, move off and do activity like that. So you're trying to move forward, but at a pace that keeps everybody coherent and involved, okay? So, you know, but as I said, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, we should have considered what are we going to do with redundant gunmen? These men who have suffered to the point of death, asking nothing, receiving nothing. Many older men have known nothing but violence, and the psychological damage has left many ill-equipped to cope with what passes for normality. And again, as we said, if you look at things like GHQ scores, 40% of the population have scores indicative of mental health problems. If you look at things like prescription rates for antidepressants or anti-anxiety drugs, I think again about 40% have been prescribed those drugs in the last 12 months. PTSD, I think 58-60% show symptomology of PTSD. So there's a lot of psychological damage because of what they've done to themselves, you know, because through their own perpetration of violence, they've harmed themselves. But, you know, if you've killed somebody, you can't go to your GP and say, oh, well, I murdered this guy and I feel really bad about it. So it's difficult then to try to get psychological assistance, psychological help. So there's these sort of problems. Plus, people have been in prison for a long time, so they come out and have all those problems that prisoners have, a readjustment as well. So the failure to give these men a role, which may be argued their sacrifice deserved, has meant for some that have created a role for themselves. What role is it for an experienced paramilitary who finds himself surplus to requirements? The answer is surely obvious. Okay, so trying to keep the organisation together has meant it's been a slow process to try to move forward because you're trying to stop it fracturing, splitting, people doing their own thing. The other big problem in loyalism, I mean, I mentioned that leadership was important, but the fact is there isn't really that many leaders, and leaders of any ability within the organisations are few and far between. Particularly, I think, since David Irvine, obviously John McMichael, things are dead, there isn't really people there to take that role on and lead them in that kind of way. So that sort of held them back as well, not having enough people to go around to sort of bring them forward and bring them through and give them advice and strategic assistance. So as this person says, as far as I'm concerned, to be a political party, you have to be educated, you have to know the system, you have to work the system. We have never had that over the years, and obviously being in 30 years of conflict, people missed the opportunity. Every time we had someone like John McMichael, who was a political genius and was trying to put forward political ways, the IRA came and wiped him out because they knew quite rightly that if we got a similar party to what they were running, we were probably unstoppable. Okay. So that lack of leadership is also a limiting factor. One of the big problems is the legacy of the conflict at two different levels. Is the level that this person's talking about, that in a way, you've had a conflict for 30, 40 years, you've demonised the enemy to that level. The propaganda that you've run within your own community to demonise them has been so strong, it's hard to give that up. You have a society that really believes conflict can solve problems. Okay, so you have a very, you know, traumatized society that still believes to a degree the violence is way forward. I mean, look at how people vote. You either vote DUP or you vote Sinn Féin. Still very divided at this point in time. That hasn't changed. So you have these sort of macro levels that makes it difficult to leave the violence behind, that legacy issue. You also have the issue in terms of the day-to-day activity for what happens to the paramilitaries, in that you have someone's doing some sort of criminal activity, so people don't go to the police because they say the police won't come here, they won't investigate the crime, so they go to the paramilitary and say, well, will you sort this person out? They're doing X, Y, and Z. So again, you have these kind of subcultures of violence where people are coming within the community trying to get the paramilitaries to engage in violence and self and police within their own communities, and these are problematic issues as well that make it difficult to move forward because they're wider than the organisation. They're really embedded within the community. Okay, so let's finish off then, give us time for some discussion. As you can see, I think through the talk, that the level of factors involved are, you know, right across the whole spectrum. You've got the sort of societal issues that can help and hinder. You've got the organizational problems, family individual level factors, again, which can help and hinder people's engagement. things that got people involved in the violence or moved people, radicalized people or mobilized people in terms of violence can also play a role in their own removal from the violence and their own disengagement as well. So similar factors like family and all that kind of stuff can play an important aspect. Again, I have to say this is for my participants, but that kind of having a set base to think. So for me, for our example, the prisoners, people who go to prison, having that time to sort of have these conversations, discussions, education, all that kind of stuff that came with it is important. But obviously, prison's a complex environment, and even within Northern Ireland, the impact imprisonment has on the prisoner depends when they're imprisoned. Okay, so whether they're in Long Cash or the H blocks, or whether the blanket protests are happening or the hunger strikes, all these things have to be taken into consideration. It's not just a straightforward prison is good, you know, for bringing about de-radicalization or disengagement. As I said, I think you can see here that disengagement does not mean de-radicalization. So the people in this who are now in the post-conflict space, engaging in community work, conflict transformation work, are doing that because of the sort of radicalized, mobilized identities, activist identities that they form through their militarism and their engagement and their imprisonment. So when we think about trying to bring in, you know, it's a very popular idea to have these programs of de-radicalization, but in some ways perhaps these could be counterproductive because you're spending time trying to de-radicalize people when you don't need to. You're probably alienating them. You're probably wasting time that could be used in trying to reintegrate those people back into society. Okay, so you know, for the population here, you know, having their old comrades association where they can still get their sense of identity, they can have their little parades and get-togethers, that lose that sense of identity is probably important, more so than trying to de-radicalize them. As I said, you find within these narrative accounts how people come in and out of the movements. They leave for particular reasons, come back into them again, do a different role, go back out, come back in, things like that. So this idea that it's very temporary, there isn't a linear pathway for these people. They come in and out different ways, different shapes, different forms for different reasons. Successful reintegration of the combatants is key. So that's what I'm saying. If you're wasting time trying to de-radicalize people when there's no need, rather than trying to get them reintegrated, is probably more important. And particularly like for everybody else, if you can't feed yourself and can't feed your family and can't have a normal life, and you know you're going to have difficulty with that integration. So probably economic barriers are more important than any kind of ideological aspect. And again, if you look at work done in Iraq and elsewhere and why people engage in insurgency there, it's not ideology, it's because you're getting paid to do it. Okay, so it's the same thing here. Money is important. So, you know, educational programs, training, jobs, that kind of stuff. As I said, one of the big problems is this legacy of the Troubles that still promotes this culture of violence. Okay, so an interesting thing that I'm trying to look at now is trying to work with these combatants to try to look at, you know, does their radicalization, does their experience of conflict help in a counter narrative way? So are they more likely to be listened to if they're talking to adolescents about not getting engaged in violence because they can sort of show how horrific it was through their own experiences and stuff like that? So can they be, you know, good agents in terms of CVE, countering violent extremism? And probably when you look at this research, you probably have to think, I mean, I'm no expert on organizational change or occupational psychology, but probably there's more to learn there than there is in terms of counterinsurgency. An organization, understand how organizations work, how you make about transformation, organizational change. I think those things are probably more important approaches to promote disengagement and move people forward. Okay, so I'll leave it there.